Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting from two snug little shipping containers in lovely Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the principals of Groundworks, Inc., where we design and build gardens all around New York City. And now that we've put most of our gardens to bed for the winter, we can engage in our other passion, which is talking about plants as our familiars and as food, fodder, and on this show, as medicine.
Today.
The plant kingdom has supplied most of our medicinal needs for almost all of human existence and continues to do so whether we realize it or not, from quinine for malaria to painkillers from willow bark to the sophisticated anti-cancer drugs coming from the Taxus family. And the study of plants' potential is as important as ever. So on today's show, to introduce and enlighten us on the topic of ethnobotany, we have as our guest Dr. Ina Vanderbroek, PhD, who is the ethno-medical research specialist at the Institute of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Garden. Dr. Vanderbroek's projects include the investigation of traditional knowledge, beliefs, and practices related to immigrant health and healthcare, including the use of medicinal plants in several Latino communities in New York City, as well as the cultural beliefs about specific illnesses that are recognized by these communities, but not as such by mainstream medicine. Dr. Vanderbroek, who is originally from Belgium, speaks five languages, including German. I'm so impressed. and has been featured on programs as diverse as the Martha Stewart Show and Nova. She was also the lead researcher on a project funded by the Belgian government titled Medicinal Plant Exploration in the Andes and Amazon Regions of Bolivia. On that project, she conducted ethnographic and ethnobotanical research in a traditional farming community in the Andes and in indigenous communities in the Amazon in Bolivia. The results demonstrated that knowledge held by traditional healers about medicinal plants can also be high in an environment such as the Andes that is significantly affected by human activity and is less diverse as compared to the tropical rainforest. Welcome, Ina.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm so glad you could join us.
From the Bronx.
Yes.
So let's talk about current medicines and you know, sort of their botanical origin. Tell us a little bit about some of the key finds in the past years that you know, you're excited about and that can be traced back to plants.
Well, we know that there are at least 119 drugs that are derived from plants, either directly or indirectly. And we know that three-fourths of those, so 75%, I think that's about 90 of these drugs, have been developed as a result from ethnobotanical leads. So they were used in traditional medicine and then later developed into drugs. Now, the question, what are the most interesting new leads coming out? You
yes.
just mentioned Taxol, right?
Yes.
Well, Taxol has been developed about 20 years ago, and it's kind of the last black blockbuster isolated single compound that comes from a plant. But I'm particularly enthusiastic about a new medicine, and it's a crude extract from a plant that we all know. It's made from the leaves of green tea. It's called virgin. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but it's an ointment that is used for sexually transmitted warts that are caused by the HPV virus. And I'm particularly enthusiastic about it because it's a mixture of plants. So it's a crude extract. It's not a single compound.
Hmm.
And it's been FDA approved.
Oh, wow. So where in the world is this found?
Sorry, where is this found?
Yeah.
It's made from the leaves of the green tea, the green tea. That we drink.
Right. But
so that's easy to cultivate and common. So
right.
That's pretty amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
So tell us about your work in Bolivia. And what did you discover there about traditional medicines and healing practices that surprised you?
Well, when I went to Bolivia, that was in 2000, now 10 years ago already, I first started working in a community of Quechua-speaking farmers in the Andes. And I had planned my research to first go to the Andes Mountains and work there because I was thinking the holy grail of knowledge about medicinal plants and traditional medicine is in the Amazon, and that's
right.
Where I'm going to find most of the interesting information. But actually it turned out the other way around. It were the people in the Andes community who knew more medicinal plants and knew their plants better than the people from the Amazon.
Oh, interesting. So were you living with a family and they were kind of teaching you their folk ways, or you were obviously working with a community? How did you get connected with the community?
Well, in the year before, in 1999, through the Belgian Development Corporation and in collaboration with a local university there, I got in touch through the students working at the university with that community of farmers. Because it's true, it's not that you can just go on a trip and say, hi, I'm an ethnobotanist,
right,
and I'm coming to study your medicinal plant knowledge.
Right.
So it's all contacts that you have, local contacts, and then you go to the community. And in my case, there was a group of 8 traditional healers working in that Quechua community in the Andes, and I presented my research ideas and proposal to them, and it was like defending a grant proposal.
Yeah.
So it took place in a local church, and they were very carefully listening to what I had to say, and then they went outside and then they deliberated about it. They were thinking whether they wanted to participate and what under which conditions they wanted to participate.
Right.
And they came back and they told me, yes, we're interested to work together with you. So then also through other contacts with a local NGO, they took me to the community. In the Andes, I stayed in a primary health care service because most of the huts that people live in have a thatched roof, and there are the bugs, the kissing bugs, that transmit diseases. So it's kind of 80% of the people was infected with that kissing bug. So it was safer for me to stay in the kissing bug parasite. Sorry, it was safer for me to stay in the primary healthcare service.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
You didn't want to be part of the experiment and protocol for yourself.
Well, but in the Amazon, I did stay with the people in their huts.
Right. Well, what were some of the things that you discovered? Like, which plants were you working with, and what discoveries did you make from their knowledge?
Well, we conducted a general ethnobotanical survey. That means you go out on field trips with them and you collect plants, you dry them, and you press them so you can identify their botanical name, because local people know their local names,
right,
in their own language or in Spanish. But if you go to another country where the same plant is growing, that plant may have a different name. So then you don't know which plant you're talking about. So that's
right,
where the botanists in the ethnobotanists come in to identify that plant. So we did a general survey. Then based on the plants that we collected, we would ask each of the 8 healers what they use the plant for, what kind of illnesses. And so then you get a large database because people know more than one health condition they use a plant for. So
sure,
you get this large information, and from that information, my students and I made a guidebook written in Spanish to give back that knowledge to the community, because it's oral knowledge.
Well, oh, right.
It's not,
yeah,
written down. So
right,
that way it gets preserved.
Uh-huh.
And that leads to the question, you know, kind of the obvious question, who does the knowledge belong to? I can understand the local people being a little bit hesitant of just allowing anybody to come in and sharing their knowledge and benefiting. I mean, you know, different groups are going to be benefiting from the knowledge. What are they going to get out of it, you know?
That's true, and that's a very valid concern, and ethnobotanists are very aware and very sensitive to the issue of intellectual property rights.
Right.
Who does that knowledge belong to? Well, my answer is the knowledge belongs to the people, and you have to be very careful what you do with it.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's also why I like to give a quantitative twist to my research, not just publish names and uses of plants, but show how knowledge is distributed in the community, who knows what and why. And then you don't necessarily have to publish these names and plants. We did publish it in a local publication, and they were co-authors on it.
Uh-huh.
On my research paper, people are also co-authors. So we're very careful, and we work out together with them the terms of our collaboration.
Right. How did you personally get involved in this field? Because I know it's fascinating, and I'm sure lots of our listeners wish that they could have your life. You get to travel,
right,
meet all these great people, work with plants.
Everyone's seen the movie Medicine Man,
yeah,
right?
Right. But I have to also say, and then it's fantastic to see it on TV, on National Geographic Channel or something, but when you're there, like, for instance, in the rainforest, I'm very careful about, you know, which student goes with me, because not everybody is fit to live there. You get bitten all over. I have students crying, and if you're there for 3 weeks, you crave mayonnaise, you crave a hot shower.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard. But it's also very fascinating, and they're wonderful people to work with, and it's a privilege to work with them.
Right.
So, no, actually, in my previous life, I was doing neuropsychopharmacology. I was working in the lab, and I was working on animal models of psychological conditions. But then I got my PhD, and I thought, this is not what I want to do. I want to do something that is relevant and combine my background in biology with my PhD training in medical sciences and do something that makes a difference. And these people, they only have primary health care, and sometimes they don't even have that. The communities in the rainforest only depend on plants for their health care.
Right.
So it is relevant, and it's knowledge that is disappearing. We all know what the state of our forest is like around the globe, and these people are also having difficulties maintaining their culture, so we need to do something there, and I felt like I could be of benefit.
Right. And how did you, if you could talk for a second about the New York Botanic Gardens program, because I know that that's actually an amazing place that doesn't get a lot of publicity for the department that you're in. Could you talk a little bit about their program?
Well, it's true. The New York Botanical Garden, the science department, it's very exciting to be there. We have great programs that focus on conservation of biodiversity. We have our taxonomists who specialize in identifying plants, and it's really a career in and by itself. And then here in the institute where I work, the Institute of Economic Botany, we specifically work, study the relationships between people and plants.
Right.
My colleagues, for example, work in Micronesia. We're also focusing on healthcare. There are other researchers that are focusing on community-based conservation. So we're really doing cutting-edge research into biodiversity, conservation, primary healthcare.
And I love that it comes from the plant end, which I think is very important, versus the medical research end. You know, it's really nice that it starts with the plants and that you all offer, NYBG offers such a long history of that sort of plant exploration and research.
That is correct.
It's not just a beautiful park. That's what we want to remind our listeners. You know,
right,
it is a beautiful park, but they're doing much more than that there.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about your, I found it really interesting, your work in Cuba, helping to develop sustainable methods of pest and disease control on their farms. Tell us what's going on there.
So in Cuba, we started working, and that's research that was funded by the Belgian Development Corporation, working together with universities over there to develop biological products that could help in deterring pests and plant diseases. And that was because of the embargo. Cuba has a hard time to acquiring outside pharmaceuticals. And we started working there, and also on the basis of traditional knowledge, what do people know about, you know, having safe crops, and how can we develop that into a product?
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting how that embargo has kind of forced them to come up with more creative, you know, solutions.
Correct.
To dealing with that. And then perhaps, you know, that knowledge can be spread beyond their borders, you know, because we certainly need help on this.
Well, this, you know, remember, Cuba is a country that doesn't offer too many internet cafes. So it's, you know, communication in Cuba is really an issue. So it's amazing that they were so receptive to welcome you.
Yes, that's true.
So, well, we have to take a break. If you'll hang with us, Ina, we are going to be back in a few minutes. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Talking today, you're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We're talking today to Dr. Vanderbrook from New York Botanic Garden, and we're talking about the discussion of plants in medicine and her work as an ethnobotanist. So one of the more fascinating projects when reading about your work was your work with the traditional healers and the medicinal or medical students, and trying to help them understand each other. How did that develop?
Well, that developed from a 2005 study here on Dominican ethnomedicine that was financed by the National Institutes of Health, National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And during that project, we discovered that 80% of the people believe that there were health conditions that a medical doctor does not understand or cannot cure, and that's why they're using herbal remedies for them. Uh-huh. We thought that was an amazing result. And then talking to doctors, they also told us that they were increasingly realizing that the underserved communities they're working with are not necessarily following up on their prescription. So people might go to a hospital to know what kind of disease they have, get a prescription, but then go out of the hospital and start using their herbal remedies, or they go to Botanicas in New York City. These are kind of community-based shops that sell herbal remedies and other products for spiritual and religious and physical well-being.
It's really fun to visit a Botanica.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you been there?
Oh, yes. Yes. Several times. Just, you know,
the candles. I just get the curiosity
and the candles. But I mean, that, you know, that's the superficial element of it. But it's the information that can be found in them is fascinating. And that's what you spend your life putting together.
Well, tell me an example of a folk illness, for example, that the doctor wouldn't believe, if you can, Ina.
Yes. Well, there are several. Right now, we are investigating 15 folk illnesses, and we are looking at how Dominicans, Mexicans, and Puerto Ricans categorize them, what they think are the symptoms, what causes them, and how they should be treated for each of these 15 folk illnesses. And one of them is the evil eye, or mal de ojo, that is known all over the world.
Right.
Another one is empacho. Sorry?
Yes, yeah, no, yes, I'm agreeing with you. Yes.
Yes. So another one is empacho. That's kind of a gastrointestinal blockade. Now, characteristic about these folk illnesses is that they may or may not be limited to a certain culture. In the case of the evil eye, it's known all over the world. But other illnesses are more specific to a certain culture, and there often is not a one-on-one correlation with a biomedical disease. So empacho can be different conditions, but local people recognize it as empacho. And because they think a medical doctor does not understand it or cannot cure it, they want to use their herbal remedies.
So what is empacho then? What would be like the symptoms of it?
It can be an indigestion, but it can be more serious as well. It's often children that are considered empachado. So then they have diarrhea, or they're crying a lot, or they're vomiting. Uh-huh. And one of the ways to treat it, it's what people call jalar el cuero, means to pull the back, the skin on the back, three times. It's often an uneven number of times. And then they give them to drink a tea of the two oreganos, the oregano that we know in our kitchen. It's not the Mediterranean oregano, though. It's another species. And there is the broad-leafed oregano, the Cuban oregano.
The Cuban, right.
Yes.
Yep.
So, sorry, Carmen. I'm fascinated with the evil eye.
Yes, I was going to admit.
Let's talk about the evil eye for a second.
Yes.
Because to me, that's kind of a psychological.
Well, I have something kind of personal to share about that. You know, my grandmother, I'm of Italian descent. I was born in Italy. And my grandmother was a healer. And anytime I went there and I wasn't feeling well, when I first got there, she would say, "You have malocchio, you have the evil eye." And she would do these ritual healing things on me, which involved olive oil and various other things. And I would say, "No, I just have, you know, I have jet lag, Grandma. I don't have the evil eye. You know, I just got off a
little melatonin, I'll be fine."
No, you definitely have the evil eye. She would inspect me and have to immediately, you know, cure me of it.
Right.
So I can relate to that evil eye aspect.
So, yeah, can you tell us a little bit about what those, like, kind of Western symptoms would be then?
Well, the evil eye can be very light. I suspect that in your case it was pretty light. But in children, because it often happens in children, the evil eye can even lead to convulsions and death, according to people's description of the symptoms. So what is, and I want to stress that, because often we say that it's psychological illnesses, but it's also known from the literature that they're associated with increased morbidity and mortality, so increased disease and increased death. So they're really worth to investigate.
Uh-huh.
And among the symptoms are, again, crying, sleeplessness. These are the more innocent ones. But the convulsions, for example,
right,
can be pretty serious. One eye or an arm or a leg can be bigger than another, is what people say.
Uh-huh.
So it's fascinating. There's this whole set of symptoms, and you can't say, oh, the evil eye is a disease, and it's this disease.
Right.
But you also cannot say it's just psychological if there can be convulsions.
Right, exactly. Because there are there are physical ramifications of psychological disorders. So it really is more a culmination of several effects.
So they see the symptoms, and then they determine if it's evil eye or not, right?
Right. And what is also interesting is that often people say, I brought my child to the doctor, and the doctor couldn't diagnose anything, so that's why it must be the evil eye. Now, Dominicans, for example, often say it's that one of your neighbors came visiting you and said to your child, "What a beautiful child," but forgot to add, "God bless the child." So that's one of the presumed causes of the evil eye.
That is so amazing, Ina, because that is exactly the same tradition in Italy, in southern Italy where I'm from. If somebody compliments you, especially a child, that is one of the ways that it can cause the evil eye and the symptoms associated with it.
Right. So that means also that as a doctor, you have to know that. So if you're a pediatrician, you have to know that you have to be careful how to compliment a child, for example.
Right.
Because everybody, it can be intentionally transmitted, but it can also be unintentionally transmitted.
This is completely fascinating to me as a, American born in the States and without any of these kind of cultural heritage.
Right, but you know what's very interesting among first-generation Dominicans?
Uh-huh.
From our study, we know that one in two people who came from a city in the Dominican Republic, who came from the countryside in the Dominican Republic, believes in the evil eye, and one in four people coming from a city believes in it. So it's not just that one or two people believe in it. The majority of the population believes that the evil eye exists, and it's something that people are hesitant to talk with their doctors about.
Right, right.
So we tried to fill in that gap.
Uh-huh.
So from our research, our results, we develop PowerPoint presentations and training sessions that we bring to medical schools here in New York City. We work together with Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Columbia University Medical Center, some community clinics for the uninsured, and so on.
Right, right. And you've also developed some ethnobotanical trials for tourists, particularly in the Dominican Republic. That certainly made us want to go. But how can you explain a little bit about that project?
Well, one summer, the Minister of the Environment, the former Minister of the Environment, Jaime David Fernandez Mirabal from the Dominican Republic, came to visit the New York Botanical Garden. And I was among the people who greeted him, and we started talking about the kind of research that I do, and it's working with the Dominican community. And he was so happy about that he said, "Well, yes, if you guys are doing that kind of research in New York, you have to come over and we have to identify ethnobotanical trails in a biodiversity area that I have just declared as a protected area. So we can bring the knowledge of the people and connect it to biodiversity as it should." And he gave us that forum to develop the trails and show that cultural heritage of Dominicans. It's very rich. It's incredibly rich. You know, when I came over and worked at the New York Botanical Garden just to work in the city with Dominican immigrants, I thought, it's a city. It's a metropolis. What kind of plans am I going to find there? I'm going to be done with my research in three months.
Yeah, exactly.
But now it's 7 years later, and I'm still here, and there is still so much knowledge that is waiting to be discovered.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting. Being a first-generation American, what you take with you and what you keep and what you discard as you come to a new country. Can you tell us what happens when the immigrants' traditional healing practice sort of intersects with modern medicine a little bit more? I mean, is there a lot of distrust of doctors? Are they, wanting to stay with their with what they know?
With their folk ways.
Or are they able to integrate it a little bit?
You mean from the doctor's side or from the patient's side?
From the patient side, I was thinking.
Well, both, actually.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Well, it can be anything. You know, the majority of Dominicans, we interviewed 175 Dominicans here in New York City, and many people would say, when my disease is not too serious, I stick with my medicinal plants because they're my culture. I have faith in them. These are plants, and plants are not chemical, and I prefer that.
Right.
But there are also people who told us, no, you know, medicinal plants and traditional medicine is something that is from the past, and we're here in New York City, and doctors know modern medicine, and that's what we should do. And there are people that combine both at the same time, or sometimes one after the other.
Right.
So you have a lot of possibilities there. So I'd say distrust, yes and no.
Well, I know a lot of hospitals are actually turning to alternative medicine as kind of a supplement to the Western practices, which I think is a really great mission for hospitals, since we are dealing with a huge community here in New York of very varied people. So it really is amazing. My father went through Memorial Sloan Kettering with lung cancer, and at the same time he was having acupressure and acupuncture
for the pain.
Mm-hmm. And it was really good, and he's really into it now, and that's, you know, that was something he probably wouldn't have gone through if he, you know, didn't get this illness. So that was amazing.
So are you finding it in your work, in your experience, are you finding that some of the doctors are receptive to working complementarily with native medicines and plants?
Well, in our focus, we're focusing on, you know, improving the dialogue between doctor and patients. I think it starts there, and then it can evolve in something that integrates both types of medicine. But we're still in the stage that we are bringing this information to medical students, residents, and practicing physicians. And then we, for example, have a role play exercise in which we present the case, like a mother thinks her child has the evil eye, doesn't want to disclose that information to you as a doctor. How are you going to ask her non-judgmental questions to get her to tell you how she thinks her child should be treated, and in that way to have better treatment of serve better healthcare for minority communities.
What's the one plant, Ina, that has most or been most interesting to you in its healing properties that you've found in your research?
Oh, there are many plants that I would be interested in. But if I just look at my research with the Dominican community, their number one plant, and they call it cure it all, is aloe vera.
Okay.
Aloe vera.
It's used for so many different things. It's used for asthma, upper respiratory tract infections, wounds, burns, diabetes, slimming, skin problems, name it, and you have it. You can use it. You can use aloe vera for it.
Yeah.
And also to bring good luck. So I kind of, you know, am amazed by a plant that sticks out so much as being so widely appreciated.
Have you personally used any of these kind of folkloric methods in lieu of Western medicine?
I have. As a scientist, I always try to... I mean, I'm not a herbalist, right?
Right.
But Dominicans, for example, have a really nice mixture of food plants that they make a sort of jarabe that's a cough syrup from that I've used. So you cut an onion, you add radish, you add watercress, some ginger, some apples, all raw, and then you add honey. You put it in the fridge, and you wait till the honey gets the juices out of your foods. And then you use that as a cough syrup. And these are, because they're food plants, I like it.
Yeah.
I like to try it. And it actually is better, I think, than a pharmaceutical medicine.
Yeah.
You know, if you can make it at home, it's nice.
Well, absolutely. It's the old adage that, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s, I always had sinus issues. And my doctor said to me very smartly in like 1972, just snort some salt water and you'll be fine. You know, clean your nose out. And there I was last night, you know, doing my little saline wash, thinking, wow, who knew that like salt water, which now you can buy, you know, it takes up three shelves
sure.
in Duane Reade. Like, you know, you can't
That's
just
simple.
You can't just make it yourself. You got to buy a product. But it really is the simple, most best, you know.
And I can relate to that as a child. You know, what is the most important liquid medicine for Italians? Well, it comes from the grape, Ina, of course, you know? So
yeah.
My parents would boil wine, boil it down, a homemade wine, of course, until it was a thick syrup. And that's what they gave us as children when we had colds.
Yeah.
We had this very thick wine syrup. They might add a little bit of sugar, but usually boiling it down kind of made it syrupy and a little sweeter. And that took care of the sore throat, the cough. It kind of mildly...
The bad attitude.
Yes. It relaxed you slightly.
Yeah. I think it was slept for a while.
Yeah, I think it was medicinal for the parents as well.
All right. Well, we have time for one more question, Ina. You participated in the Venice Biennale in 2009. That seems like a surprising venue for somebody with your background. How did you get involved and what was that all about?
Well, that's actually going back to my past. When I was 12, 13 years old, my art teacher in school, he, you know, has always been interested in plants, and he's been working for years on, you know, incorporating aspects, social and biological aspects in his research. His name is Jeff Gaze, and he's considered a big European artist. And he was selected by the Belgian King to present his work at the Venice Biennale. And because he was my art teacher, and my parents had run into him at the supermarket, because they live in the same town, and of course my mother, you know how mothers are, said, you know, my daughter is in New York City and she's working at the New York Botanical Garden. And he said, oh, how fantastic, I have to get in touch with her. So he's a conceptual artist, so he collaborates with people from different disciplines.
Uh-huh.
So he thinks about the idea, and he gave me the idea, he gave me a task in New York City, in a number of square kilometers from your home, from where you live, go out and collect 12 weeds that have medicinal value, with the idea, a concept of, if a homeless person in New York City has a toothache, what kind of a plant could he find in his surroundings that could help him?
Brilliant. Brilliant.
So I made collections of plants like I always do. I dried them, pressed them, and added ethnobotanical information on the medicinal uses of these plants.
Uh-huh.
And that was part of the Venice Biennale exhibit. So he gave me as an ethnobotanist a forum to bring my work to a wider audience, which is why I did it. Not
right.
because I thought all of a sudden, oh my God, I'm an artist.
No, right.
But, you know, as a researcher, to develop these kind of interdisciplinary collaborations, it's very exciting.
It is. It's great. And that's what makes New York Botanic Garden and New York City so alive, is all the interdisciplinary connections and the communities and the people that have made the city what it is. So it's a great wrap-up for you personally and for our show today, unfortunately, because we are out of time.
Thank you, Ina, so much for being with us. Hopefully we can have you on again.
And I want to know what was the remedy for the toothache?
Oh,
within your...
a plant used for toothache.
Yeah.
That was just the idea. So it was just any weed that I could find and what the medicinal uses of that weed are.
Got
the toothache was just an example.
Okay, so I'm not going to be going and picking artemisia and rubbing it on my teeth.
I didn't find one for toothache, actually.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for being on the show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ina.
Thanks for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. The show is going to be available for listening via archive at heritageradionetwork.com and also via podcast. We'll be posting a link to the New York Botanic Garden website on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants. Thanks to Jack Inslee for producing and to Carlos Aguero for engineering. See you next week.
This is a message from Sea to Table. Can the fish come back to South Street? On December 18th, the New Amsterdam Market will pay homage to the old Fulton Fish Market by including a special section dedicated to the fisheries of the Northeast and New England with Sea to Table. Sea to Table partners with fishermen in the recovering fisheries of the Northeast. Their transparent model, delivering fish direct from docks to chefs across America, supports the traditional fisheries that are crucial to the survival of our working waterfronts. For the first time, Sea to Table will join the market to offer fresh fish direct from independent Northeast fishermen. The collaboration of Sea to Table with New Amsterdam will take us back in time for a day to the era when fishmongers dominated Lower Manhattan. So stop by the New Amsterdam Market at Peck Slip and South Street in Manhattan on December 18th and support your local fishermen and fisheries. For more information on Sea to Table, visit www.seatotable.com. That's seatotable.com. The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Looking for that perfect Christmas tree this season? What about the perfect wine to go with your holiday dinner? Look no further than Jones Family Farm, a 400-acre working farm in Connecticut. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. For more information, visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com.